Guardian Unlimited.
Hello, I'm Jane Ferguson, editor of the Observer Review. Welcome to our series of talks in association with Blackwells. This time, we have Germaine Greer talking about her new book, Shakespeare's Wife.
Hello. Congratulations. You got here despite everything. I should congratulate me. I got here despite everything as well. I seem to have sat in stationary traffic, being slowly gassed by particulates all day. I'm going to talk to you about my new book, Shakespeare's Wife. I've been talking about it all day. I may get to the point where I start repeating myself like a broken record, but we'll try and avoid that if we can. 5 o'clock start, though, sometimes means I feel a bit dizzy at that stage. If I plunge off this stool on my head, don't panic, I'll be fine. We don't break bones in my family, but we do go gaga, so. So this book, everyone says, well, why would you write a book about Shakespeare's wife? And you could make the usual answer, which is, why not? But it's never struck me as a good answer. Although, it is odd that no one's ever felt strongly enough to begin to really look for this woman and see who she was. What makes it odd to me is it's quite clear that for Shakespeare, marriage was really important. Shakespeare's the person who invented the comedy of wooing and wiving. Why does someone like Steve Greenblatt, who was at Cambridge with me, why would he want me to believe that Shakespeare hated his wife? What kind of thing is it to say about a man that he hates his wife? If he hates his wife, why doesn't he leave her? Wouldn't that be the obvious thing to do? But Shakespeare doesn't leave his wife. He comes back to Stratford, to her house, and he dies there. You may say, well, he had nowhere else to go, but he did. If you know your Shakespeare documentation, you'll know that he was the mortgagee, the principal titular owner of the gatehouse in Blackfriars that was bought for the king's men. He could have lived there. There's a man who interests me in the Shakespeare story, whom no one's investigated either, who's a man called John Robinson. And he keeps appearing like King Charles's head. He pops up at a strange point in the fortunes of the Globe Theatre. Burbage wanted to build an indoor theatre in Blackfriars, and he actually spent a huge amount of money refurbishing a building, and then the other principal tenants of properties in Blackfriars petitioned to have the theatre not open, which for Burbage was a disaster. And one of the signatories to that petition was a man called John Robinson. John Robinson turns up again as a witness to Shakespeare's will. I mean, you could write a novel about John Robinson, the unknown man in the Shakespeare biography. And I thought, well, maybe he was like the dresser, you know, in that film. Maybe he was Shakespeare's manservant and Shakespeare's valet. And maybe he came back to Stratford with him. Maybe. John Robinson, by the way, also ends up being the tenant of the Blackfriars Gatehouse. Now, you may say, where does all this come from? I've never heard this about Shakespeare's biography. The fact is, there's quite a bit of documentation of Shakespeare. And it's been worked over and worked over and worked over and interpreted and reinterpreted to mean all kinds of different things. Shakespeare was gay, Shakespeare wasn't gay, Shakespeare was a Catholic, is their favourite at the moment. They're very keen on that. I think that's wrong. But it's true, he talks about purgatory and all that. But, you know, people don't forget their Catholic past just because the monasteries are sacked. People remember the way they thought. They still talk about Our Lady. They still swear in the same language. So, you could write a biography of John Robinson. Now, if you were going to do that, you'd use it, wouldn't you, to build up the whole theatre scene, who worked in the theatre, who came into the theatre, what the economics of the theatre might be. There'd be a way of doing it, even though we know nothing about this man. Shakespeare's shadow, Shakespeare's Horatio, John Robinson. No one's ever done it. And the same is true of Shakespeare's wife. Now, when I was a working academic, when I had a CV and all that, would I have started to work on Shakespeare's wife? I don't really think I would have, because it would have been regarded as in for a dig. You know, what, she's turning it into a soap opera. It's so girly. Why does she care about Shakespeare's wife? You know, we are academics. We deal with the plays, na-na-na-na-na. And also, they might also know that I hate literary biography, because I think it's usually a case of lesser writers processing greater writers through their own bowels with predictable results. The greater cannot come from the less. So I would never have written a biography. Well, I have written biographies of Shakespeare, because you have to. Every now and then you get asked by somebody preparing a new edition, could you give us a biography? And so you do. And what I've always done is model any biography I wrote of Shakespeare on the basic documentation as has been supplied by the late, great Samuel Schoenbaum. Nothing has proceeded beyond Schoenbaum's documentary life, except one thing that I'm going to cite to you now as an example of how things become overinterpreted outside a context. Jonathan Bate, in a very, very generous review of my book, which I don't deserve because I totally blagged the RSC Shakespeare, points out that there's a piece of information about the folio that I don't know. And he sort of forgives me for not knowing it. And I thought, what's he talking about? So I traipsed along to the RSC Shakespeare. I thought, if it's anywhere, it's going to be in the biography in there. So I poked around, had a look, and guess what it was? Now, you think about this. It's actually the evidence of a single word written against Shakespeare's name in one copy of the 1623 folio. Shakespeare died in 1616, right? This word, I think I'm right in saying, is being interpreted as evidence that Shakespeare left the theatre quite early on, earlier than we think. We think he quit the court around 1612, 1613, but this was taken as evidence that he left much earlier. And it is a single word written against his name in the list of members of the company. And it says either leased or ceased. It's not evidence of anything. Because it's 7 years after Shakespeare's death, probably more than 10 years after he last appeared with the King's Men. It's written, we don't know when, in a book published in 1623. Now, those of you who deal with evidence will realize it's not going to get you anywhere. I think it's conceivable that Shakespeare left court fairly early too, but for a reason, which is that I suspect that he had been being treated for syphilis for a very long time, and there were lesions visible on his face, in his beard and hair in particular, and if you had scabs of any sort, you could not be at court for obvious reasons, because you were a danger to the monarch. And they would have had to let him go. He might still have been a fantastic playwright. I think the way to look at syphilis in the 16th century is to think of it as HIV/AIDS. We're working very hard to remove the stigma from HIV/AIDS now, and the same is true in the 16th century. It was an occupational hazard. People didn't understand how easy it was to get the disease, and the treatments were more devastating than the disease, terribly expensive and dreadfully painful. If that's what happened to Shakespeare, it's really heartbreaking. It's a heartbreaking story. And it might explain why our greatest playwright died in his prime, died in the in what should have been a hale middle age. So I was saying that I wouldn't have written anything about Shakespeare's wife when I was part of the Shakespeare establishment. I think I would have been, well, I know I would have been condescended to, and I might have disapproved of myself. So you might wonder, well, what makes the difference? Somebody said to me, you know, what is a feminist doing writing about wives? I said, why wouldn't I? Yes, but you're defending a wife. Well, yes, I'm defending her against gratuitous insult by my colleagues. It's not to say I'm defending marriage. What I'm trying to explain is what view of marriage Anne would have had and how she would have respected it in her own life. I'm trying to get justice for her. That's all. But why is it important? And I think, well, isn't the truth important just because it's the truth? If you think something is outrageously misogynistic and irresponsible, then shouldn't you say so? But really, the story is a little bit different, I realize. When I first went up to Cambridge in 1964, having flown from my native land, I meant to be an affiliated student. And after a little while, I discovered that would be a complete waste of time. So in a spirit of some regret, because I didn't really want to do a research degree, I applied to read for a research degree at Cambridge and to do work on the ethic of love and marriage in Shakespeare's early comedies. I had begun to suspect that when Shakespeare wrote plays about wooing and wedding, he wasn't reworking old plays. I couldn't find them. I could look uphill and down dale. There was no literary genre, at any rate, that corresponded to the comedy of wooing and wedding. And this began to indicate that Shakespeare invented it, that rather than writing in an existing genre, he invented a genre. So then you think, well, why wasn't there such a genre anywhere else? What was going on in England that made it relevant to do this? So I began to read the literature all around marriage. I began to read commentaries on the Bible. I began to read devotional books. I began to read anti-Catholic propaganda. I began to read ballads and all kinds of things, and gradually worked up this huge body of stuff that I presented to my supervisor, who is the person to whom this book is dedicated. And she looked at me as if to say, Jermaine, what is this? And I said, well, it's all the stuff I've done on marriage in Shakespeare's time. She said, but it's not literature, and you're supposed to be doing literature. I said, well, okay, sorry. So I shouldered my wadge, and I took it off to the social historians. The Cambridge Demographic Study Group, led by Peter Laslett, that used to meet in his rooms in college, and I trotted in there with my big wadge and said, please, could I give a paper on the propaganda surrounding marriage in the 16th century? They said, no. I said, why? They said, because we don't accept literary evidence. Oh, great. Because literary evidence is not an indication of what's happening. Because it's made up and stuff. We want you to deal with hard fact. We want you to go and read parish registers. We want you to list all the information you can get out of parish registers, analyze the figures, do statistical analysis, da-da-da. And I said, well, no, I'm not doing that. I said, you do that, and I'll use your conclusions when you come to them. And off I trotted and went and did my proper PhD and gave up all dreaming of the wodge. And every now and then, every 5 or 6 years, I'd think, oh, there's all that work I did. I must be able to turn it into something. So I'd try and move it around. And I even designed the book and designed the cover and everything, Love and Marriage in the 16th Century, you know. But no, I realized that publishers weren't going to really be interested. It was going to be Yawnsville. You know, what is this? Why do we have to do? Who will read this? Me. I was about the only person I knew who would. And it was only about 2 years ago I thought, you know, there is a way to do this. And then when I read Steve Greenblatt's book, I was really shocked, I think. I couldn't understand why he needed to say that about her. Why did he need to talk about Shakespeare having a physical revulsion to his wife's body. Where would that come from? You know, it's like Tina Brown writing about Princess Diana's orgasms. Hey, Tina, who told you that, James Hewitt? And I just thought, nah, come on. This has got to be wrong. You know the quatrain on Shakespeare's tomb? Steve Greenblatt interprets that as meaning that he couldn't bear the thought of his wife's bones being put in the tomb with his, which isn't, of course, what he says. He says, cursed be he who disturbs his bones, not who opens the tomb and puts more bones in. That's not what he actually says. Supposing he says it, it's a ridiculous quatrain, and you can find it somewhere else. I think it used to be printed on buns somewhere in England at some point. And I thought, well, hang on. There is a case to be made here for this woman. And it actually would be a case that redeemed Shakespeare. Because I think a man who hates his wife and doesn't dare leave her is every kind of a creep. I just couldn't think that my Shakespeare, whom I've loved all my life, could be a creep of that order, which is not to say that I think he was the man of the millennium, you know, pure, white, wonderful, honest, sincere, straightforward, consistent, all that. I think he was a genius, and geniuses are tricky to live with. They're tricky to deal with. You might have noticed this week we've had all this bitching about Arthur Miller, who was not able to cope with the fact that Inga Morat bore him a Down syndrome baby, so the baby was instantly placed in care. Nowadays, we regard that with intense disfavour. At the time when it happened, it wasn't at all unusual. But now he's going to be judged by our criteria and found wanting, and the fact that he was also a communist is going to be added into the mix. And, you know, the Daily Mail is going to trumpet, look, look, he wasn't even a human being. So I began to think really hard about this, and then I realized I can do the two things. Because if I think about Anne from what I know about the social history of the second half of the 16th century, I can make her a much more interesting person for the public out there, 55% of which is female. And it's really, and also because there's such a knee-jerk tradition of being rude about the wives of geniuses, from Socrates down, Milton, everybody, even Wordsworth. Certainly Byron, except in Byron's case, I think his wife was probably a better person than he was. Which is not to say I don't love Byron, I do, but it's indubitable that he was an absolute rat to his wife. And, you know, great men, clever men, brilliant men can be rats to all kinds of people. But this woman, this silent woman who was somehow there all the way through Shakespeare's life, there and not there, began to really get me. So, what do we know about her? We knew, first of all, that she was 67 in 1623, and that meant she was 7 years older than Shakespeare. For most of the commentators, that was all you needed to know. 8 years older than Shakespeare. That was all they needed to know. An older woman, oh God, how dreadful. There she obviously was, dewlaps, whiskers, and randy as all get out, frustrated, left on the shelf. And here comes Shakespeare, hello trees, hello sky, a sweet 18-year-old boy, and this bearded harpy leaps out from a bush and gets herself pregnant by him and then says, ha 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 ha, you'll have to marry me, Will Shakespeare. It's obviously nonsense. And those of you who've been through the Oxbridge Mill will realize that it was the big fantasy of all the male tutors that their beautiful boys would be drawn away from a brilliant future by some money-grubbing little creature who managed to creep in to one of the women's colleges. Very strange stuff, basically. But you'll think I'm joking. When I went up to Cambridge, wives were not allowed to eat on high table. For all I know, they're still not to be invited. The fellows are allowed to come. You see, once upon a time, fellows couldn't even have wives. I think it was only when the venereal disease statistics became overwhelming they thought there might be a better solution. So, if I think, what do we know? She was 8 years older than Shakespeare. She outlived him by 7 years. But she's buried next to him. And that should suggest that the marriage survived. It may have been a distant marriage, it may have been cold, it may have been difficult, but commitment was still a part of it. There was no question of pretending it had never happened, for example. Okay, the next thing we discover, Nicholas Rowe tells us that her name was Anne Hathaway, and she was the daughter, I think he says, of a yeoman. Well, that's wrong. She's actually a rung or two further down the social scale. But her father, Richard Hathaway, left a will. We know he was a husbandman, and we probably, I mean, this is a little difficult, and I'm hoping that students in future will work harder on this than I was able to. The family seems to me to have been largely Puritan, i.e. reforming Protestant. Not Puritan in the sense that it will come to mean later in the 17th century, not as in Roundheads, but Puritan as in reforming Protestant, as distinct from Whitgift, who brings back in some of the usages of the old church into the new church. These are the bright, burning people who want a totally new religion that is free of superstition, that is based on the word of the Bible. And it's an immensely strong and vivid, wonderful movement in this period. And it looks to me as if her father, Richard Hathaway, belongs to this persuasion. There's certainly no doubt that her brother, Bartholomew Hathaway, was a Calvinist. He talks of himself as hoping to be of the elect in his will, for example, which makes it pretty clear. Richard Hathaway died in 1581, I think September. In November 1582, a special application is made to the Consistory Court, which is the court of the bishop at Worcester, for a special license to marry William Shakespeare and somebody. It got into a bit of a mess because it got mixed up with this woman called Anne Whateley. Now, what's interesting about that is that my colleagues all assume that Anne Whateley, whom he didn't marry, was the girl for him. And Anne Hathaway, whom he did marry, was the wrong one. I never know why they can't think of it the other way around, that Anne Hathaway came in to rescue him from marrying Anne Whateley, but, you know, there's a limit. They like to think that Anne Whateley was gorgeous and young, maybe 16. You know, our culture is pedophilic, so the younger they can get her, the better. And here is, instead, is this bearded hag of 26 saying, "Excuse me, William Shakespeare, your baby brags in my belly." Because that's the next thing they find, of course, is the baptism of Susanna Shakespeare in May in 1583. And they say, "My God, she was pregnant. Oh, the slag." I mean, this is 19th century thinking. He obviously had to marry her to save her reputation. And they get completely carried away and talk about her as heavily pregnant and being disgraced. And they don't do the simplest thing of all, which is to go to the parish registers, have a look and see who got married in 1582, and have a look and see when their first children were baptized. And they would have found that about a third are lost to follow-up, and another third baptized their babies within 9 months, and some within three. And they don't seem to be in the least bit ashamed. There is no question of any sanction against them. If they'd done that, they'd have known that there was no question of Anne being disgraced, just as there's no question but that she was pregnant. So they've interpreted the great haste to get married with one announcing of the banns as being to do with her pregnancy, which I think is wrong. And I'm not at all sure that we've got the right explanation of why there is a bond. But it's all rather technical, and I won't hold you up at this stage of the game with the ins and outs of the consistory courts and ecclesiastical law under Elizabeth. But some of you may be aware that under Edward VI there was a move to systematize ecclesiastical law, but it never happened. It was never enacted. So Elizabeth inherited a bit of a mess where ecclesiastical law was concerned. And I've argued that it's just possible that Anne and Will were separated by spiritual consanguinity, which is too complicated to go into. But anyway, As far as I can make out, in the 1580s, there was no stigma on giving birth within 9 months of marriage. It carried no penalty, and it was so common as to be virtually the norm. So you once you start saying, look, she wasn't desperate. Oh, and the other thing was that at 26, they said, oh, she's 8 years older than him. And, you know, people like Aykroyd and Holden say, she was half as old again. Oh, how disgusting, how awful. In fact, she was the right age to be married. The person who was the wrong age was William. He was 18. He had no prospects. He'd been bred to no trade. His family were sliding onto the skids, been on the skids by that time for a couple of years. It looks as if all the family property was gone or in the process of being gone. He wasn't a catch. A girl in her right mind wouldn't have wanted him. And I think we ought to consider the possibility that Anne, with her little dowry of 10 marks, enough to build a cottage, was really meant to marry a nice farming boy and settle down, adopt all the skills she'd learnt in her father's household, and just become a farmer's wife. Instead, she wound up with William Shakespeare, a brilliant boy who had nothing. And there's only one reason for her doing that, as far as I can see, and that is that she loved him, and that he got her, he won her. And what did he have to win her with? Poetry. He didn't have anything else. Now you say, oh, come on, Germaine, you're kidding. You mean Anne Shakespeare could read? Well, yes, I do mean that. She may not have been able to write. In fact, she almost certainly couldn't write. They are two very different skills. We tend to talk about literacy as if reading comes with writing. But of course it doesn't. And to learn to write, you need a writing master. You need paper. Or you can start off on a slate, but you're not best advised to keep on going on a slate. Paper's very expensive. Ink is even more expensive. And why would a young woman learn to write? If you teach them to write, they might write what they think. And no one terribly wants them to be doing that. But she would certainly, I think, just about certainly have been able to read. And the thing she read was her Bible, small enough to fit into her apron pocket. That Bible would have been the Geneva Bible, which is also Shakespeare's Bible. If you think about it, the authorized version comes in with King James. By that time, both Anne and William had grown up with the Bible in their hands. She would have learned to read so that she could read the Psalms and the readings for every day. Now, if you think about what that means, the Psalms, as in the translations by Coverdale and Tyndale, are wonderful poetry. So she knew, even not knowing that she knew it, she would have known something about poetry. And words would have been important to her. She would have been aware of the magic of words. We never study the Psalms in our universities. We tend to teach literature without reference to the Hebrew tradition. But if you think back to your Psalms, they're full of things you're familiar with. The poet speaking in the first person, the poet addressing a god, the poet dramatizing situations, positing confrontations outside the actual scope of the poem. All these are things that happen within the sonnets, for example. There is a real connection between the reading of the Psalms and the development of English vernacular poetry. So I would have thought, even without current opinion, that Anne could probably read and that William probably wooed her with poetry. You might say, well, why would he do that? And the answer has to come back the same. Because he loved her, because he wanted her. He didn't care, you would think, that she was older than he. And if you look at the dynamic of the plays, just think about it. Doesn't Portia seem older than Bassanio? Doesn't Rosalind seem older than Orlando? How often are women in the teaching situation? Beatrice seems older than Benedict. Doesn't matter where you look, you've got women who seem adult and men who appear to be boys. Now, the interesting thing is that for Elizabethans, the seducer, the person who seduced young women of substance, was not a sort of 30-year-old Melvin Douglas type with a moustache and a bowler hat. He was a boy. He was a willful boy. You remember Orsino saying to Cesario, "She will take it better from you than in annuncios of more grave aspect. You go and woo her for me. You'll be more successful than I am." And Cesario goes and does it, and is very aggressive and very sexy little lover, even though he's actually a girl. So I don't find it intrinsically unlikely that this clever boy didn't really like dizzy girls of his own age, that he was actually intrigued by this different kind of person. I think she was rather austere, rather quiet, and perhaps even slightly forbidding. I don't know, of course. So, even the most crusty Don thinks that Shakespeare wrote one sonnet, Sonnet 145, to Anne Hathaway, or about Anne Hathaway. And once you let in one sonnet, you're going to have to let in some more. Or you're at least going to have to consider them. And they've never done that. Oh, yes, that one, maybe, because it's got a pun in it about Hathaway. So perhaps that was about her. Okay, fine. She can have that one, rather crummy one. But she can't have any of the others. And I happen to think that's probably wrong. So what happens next? She has Susanna. Does Shakespeare cut and run? I've done the right thing. I've married her. I'm off. No, he sticks around and he gets her pregnant again, which would indicate, Professor Greenblatt, that she didn't disgust him then. And then what happens? She gives birth to twins. Now, it's funny, isn't it, that the Dons take that in their stride. Oh, yes, then she had twins. Na, 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 na. And you want to say, do you realise what it's like having twins? Ever thought about it? It's tough enough now having twins. Now they'll monitor you from the beginning of your pregnancy. They'll worry about discordancy. They'll want to make sure that the twins are properly positioned in utero. They want to make sure that your labour is correctly handled. They might induce you early because the risks increase the further down towards term you go. Who's going to do this for Anne? Nobody. And what that signifies to me is that she was probably physically strong. Maybe not robust. I mean, I'm not saying she was, you know, Mrs. Atlas. But the next thing is that she goes through a double labour, which is, and I've included in the book, just so you realise how grim this is likely to be, what the midwives say about delivering twins. Most of them don't say anything. And that's probably because it was usually a bloodbath. They usually got it completely wrong. The ones who do mention it say the most terrible things, like, if both babies rush into the birth canal together, you must take great care to push one back. Can you imagine what that means in terms of the time spent in the birth canal, about starvation of oxygen and so on? So there's the midwife tugging one baby, trying to hold the other baby back, because if they come together, they may become impacted in the birth canal and she'll lose them all, the babies and the mother. I mean, it was horrifying. When I, again, in my sort of really pedestrian way, I just went and looked at the Stratford registers. How many twins were christened in Holy Trinity Church? That was interesting because there were quite a few, rather too many, because we end up with a ratio in Stratford of about 1 to 40 births of twins, which is about twice the going ratio now. So we seem to have had a bit of a focal point of twinning for genetic reasons or whatever other. But then I went and looked at the burials, and lo and behold, there were twins who were buried without ever being baptized because there was no chance. They were dead and they couldn't be baptized dead, so they were buried nameless. And in that case, it just said, two infants of so-and-so, two infants of somebody else. And then I found miscarriages of twins as well. What did Anne do? She went through her double labour, and she kept her twins alive. To me, that means one thing, that she was incredibly resourceful and strong. There she was, exhausted by a double labour, having to establish feeding the two babies, and one of the babies was almost certainly weaker than the other. And I think the one who was weaker was probably Hamnet, the boy. They were not identical twins, and identical twins were often delivered more easily because they only had one placenta. When you have non-identical twins, fraternal twins, according to the local midwives, the contemporary midwives, you were more likely to lose one or the other. And they dreaded it. I think everybody dreaded a twin confinement. But she did it, and she kept her boy alive till he was 11. He died in the summer. He died in August. Now, people often died in August when there was a disease going the rounds, you know, scrub typhus, typhoid, diarrheal disease. There were all kinds of summer plagues. But this was a wonderful summer. And only four people died that month, an old man, two newborns, and Hamnet. And that gives me further cause to think that Hamnet did sustain some kind of a birth injury. No one writing about Shakespeare has ever considered it for a second. And it's shocking in its way because they were common. They weren't an unusual thing. It was a fairly common thing to find cerebral palsy in children born in these rough and ready circumstances. And they didn't do well because there was no way of caring for them in working families amongst poor people. In very primitive housing, for example. So Anne did really well to bring her boy, I think, to the threshold of adolescence. And then I think that she lost him then. What he'd been struggling against overwhelmed him, whatever it was. And my male colleagues like to say, well, of course, Shakespeare hastened home for the funeral. What would have been the point of that? These are practical people. Shakespeare was touring with his company in Kent. It would have taken a week to get somebody to find him. It's not as if there was a newspaper and they could read, you know, the Lord Chamberlain's men are at present at so-and-so. That's not what happened. I'm sure he didn't make it back, and no one would have minded. And so I thought quite hard about the way the funeral would have been. There would have been no coffin. They didn't have coffins. He would have been born on a tabletop or a door. And Anne would have been the chief mourner, rather more than the Shakespeare family, I think. And the people would have come out of their houses in silence to watch as the little body was taken up to the churchyard. And they would have taken off their caps as a sign of respect to her and to him. And I wondered if she felt bitter. I wondered if she was angry because she'd had such trouble, you know, feeding Hamnet, getting him to eat, this little frail boy who might have been pining for his father. Maybe she was in a black rage when she walked up there to Holy Trinity Churchyard. Have we ever looked for Hamnet's little grave? Never. We wouldn't find it, probably. It's a river meadow and he's probably mud by now, but if I thought about that whole heroic struggle and losing it, and you know the thing that really crushed me, if you've ever read the dedicatory epistle to Venus and Adonis, read it now. Because Shakespeare says to Southampton, if this first issue of my brain proved deformed, then, and you know, he would abandon it and he would never take up poetry again. You think, was that running on his mind in 1594? And, you know, if you're thinking about Steve Greenblatt and his whole thing about being revolted by her body, is Greenblatt not saying that maybe she bore a damaged child? And, you know, what makes it really hard is that people thought that twins came about because of excessive sexual desire in one or other parent. They thought they were conceived by superfetation, that the woman already impregnated once, especially with fraternal twins, was impregnated a second time, and that it was bestial. There was a prejudice against twinning. Wouldn't that be just the most terrible thought, that Shakespeare was revolted by his wife because she had borne him a monstrous child, a child that was not perfect. Many a young man doesn't cope with that. In our own world, many a young husband runs away because his narcissism won't accept that this is his child. But the mother has no doubt. I hope that didn't happen. And it's only the dedicatory letter to Venus and Adonis that just makes the cold drops go down my spine. But just like it is with Arthur Miller, he wasn't equal to his Down syndrome child. And maybe Shakespeare wasn't equal to Hamlet. Do you know that some of the dons have even said that Shakespeare couldn't forgive Judith, Hamlet's sister twin, for being the one to survive? They really aren't embarrassed what they say about Shakespeare. Was he such a stupid man that he didn't know that the person who would be most deeply bereaved would be the sister who lost her twin? Can he have been such a drip? Can he have been so thick-skinned? I can understand him not being able to deal with it. But if you're going to charge Shakespeare with lack of imagination? Now, have these people no humility at all? So this, you see, all I'm doing is what anybody has the right to do. I'm taking the incontrovertible evidence of the facts as we know them, and I'm interpreting them from a different angle. No one has ever said, what does it tell you about Anne Hathaway that she bore twins and she kept them alive? And that's where I get my idea that she was strong, that she was resourceful, that she was capable. The next thing they want to say is, oh, they say, well, Shakespeare then left her. Oh, great. Newborn twins, one possibly not very well, and a toddler, and he just buggers off. Oh, yes. Seriously? Seriously, you think he deserted her? Oh, well, we don't know. He went somewhere. You don't actually know that he went anywhere, in point of fact. Now, you know, if he had deserted her, if he'd just walked out, and she had gone to the vicar's court. Remember, her brother is a church official. Not at this point, but later. At this stage, he's a minor church official. If she'd gone to the vicar and said, my husband has left me with these children and no means of support, then the order would have gone out for his arrest. He would have been a fugitive from the law. If it didn't go out, if we hear nothing of any attempt to bring him back, then it means she didn't complain. And what that means is that he went with her blessing. And that makes me think even harder about what kind of a woman this was, who would look at her young, beautiful, clever, amazing, charming husband, who lit up every day of her life, and see that he was miserable and frustrated and hampered, that there was nothing for him in Stratford, and say, I can handle this. I can handle the children. I can handle everything. I just can't handle you. You think you've got it in you to be something special? Go. Try. Do your best. I can't see any other way for it to happen because he couldn't have gone otherwise. Then she has to face being alone, sleeping in an empty bed, or rather, she probably slept in a bed full of babies, actually. This is my girl. This is my Anne Hathaway. She may be a fiction, but she's a fiction that's more interesting to me than the kind of Aunt Sally that the male tradition has set up. I think in many ways she was very separate from her husband. It would be normal. Women had their friends in Elizabethan England, and men had their friends. You didn't have what you've got now, which is sort of compulsory heterosexuality, that a dinner party has to be four blokes and four girls. You could have eight girls and no blokes, and vice versa. You know, the women had their own social life, and it was based on things like baptisms and churchings, and the best ale would be poured for the women, and they would talk and feast and get a bit drunk and have a great time. And sometimes the men had to wait on them as well, because this was their festival. And it was understood that they had, the women had their own gossips and their own life. They weren't meant to appear everywhere as, you know, Cherie Blair clamped onto the side of Tony Blair. It wasn't necessary, wanted, respected, or anything. So you can see how I might move on from that to develop the whole story of this woman. She must have been able to feed her little ones, even though she couldn't leave the house. There must have been something she could do. Now, you may say, well, she obviously lived with her in-laws. That's what all the men have said. But they didn't. It didn't happen in Shakespeare's Stratford. Families were based on a single married couple. You never got a doubling. Very seldom got a doubling. And as well as that, the Shakespeare family was so poor by this stage, they couldn't possibly have fed another four mouths. Food is the most expensive item in Elizabethan housekeeping, and they simply couldn't have done it. She must have been able to do it. Otherwise, he would have been disgraced. So then I have a wonderful time figuring out what she did. She did not do as the Daily Mail reviewer seems to think I said she did, because the Daily Mail reviewer stopped reading about chapter 6, I think, and just decided to diss the book out of hand, which was rather odd. But never mind, it happens. What I actually said, if you were thinking, I'm actually a bit sick of the sound of my own voice, so we can start talking to each other now. If you were thinking, there is a woman with a toddler, two little ones, one of whom might be frail, living in a two-bedroom cottage, which has sort of kitchen room with a fireplace, it has a sleeping room, and it has a solar above, which is where you keep stores and where in the winter, because it's lit, you might be able to do some kind of work. What do you think she might have done? What could you do without leaving the house? What do you reckon? You might come up with a totally new suggestion that I haven't thought of. So go for it. What do you think?
Sewing.
Sewing, certainly. The problem with sewing is it's one of the things that women did have to do for their families. It's quite hard to make sewing really pay. You've got to get, if you're going to do sewing to sell, someone has got to help you. But you're right, it's a possibility. Did you know that Shakespeare had brothers? Yes? But most people kind of know. Shakespeare had three brothers. This always knocks me out. Why has no one ever bothered to find out anything about them? Well, partly because they're totally obscure. One of them is Gilbert. Gilbert could read and write because he signed a document in a very fine italic hand. That's all we've got to signify that. And he gave evidence in a rather unsavory court case in London, and he's described as a haberdasher of St. Bride's Parish. Now, a haberdasher sells all those ribbons and gewgaws and ties and points and bits of lace and old silk and hats and gloves and anything, really. You remember Autolycus? Autolycus is a peddler, but he's a peddler with rather superior line in haberdashery. The girls bought ribbons for festival days. You gave people penny gloves when they had a wedding or something like that. It's big business, but it's almost below the radar. And there's a network that goes everywhere of people making things for the haberdashers to sell and being given things to make out of linen and silk. There is inkle, tapes, edgings, and so on. What you'd need if you were going to sew for a living would be someone to bring you patterns and someone to find clients for you. She couldn't have been a laundress because she would have had to take the washing to the riverside and beat it on the stones. She couldn't leave the house for such a long period. She would have had a maidservant. But even so, with three small children, you don't leave the house in the care of a maidservant. That's asking for it to burn down. Stratford burnt down three times in Shakespeare's lifetime. Burning down was common. So I think she didn't do washing. I think she didn't work in the fields for the simple reason that it was seasonal and it was very badly paid. She could have taken the babies with her and put them, you know, in among at the corner of the field to play with older children, and gone out there and hoed. But for tuppence a day, and as it was not to be relied on according to weather and harvest and so on, she probably didn't do that. She could have washed the dead and laid them out. That was another job that women had, usually older women than Anne. And she mightn't have liked to do that because she might have understood that she might be bringing diseases home to her little ones. Sewing is one idea. Another one? Knitting is my favorite. And you know why it's my favorite? It's such a neat story. Stockings in the 16th century, at the beginning of the 16th century, in England, were made of bias-cut linen and stitched up in pieces. Can you imagine what it was like curtsying with a bias-cut linen stock? You'd saw your leg off. Henry VIII was offered knitted silk stockings from Spain and rejected them as kind of puffery. She didn't want to know about such girly things. Edward VI was offered some, but poor boy, probably his dreadful preceptors didn't let him even know about them. Everything changes when Lady Montagu makes Queen Elizabeth a present of a pair of black silk knitted hose. The Queen pulls them on to her freckly leg and says, "I am never wearing woven hose ever again. These are total bliss." What happens then is that knitting just expands exponentially. And we get knitting of all kinds, knitting mostly worsted thread, which is a long staple wool of the kind that you could harvest from sheep in the Midlands. We generally think of knitting as being connected to places like Nottingham or even Norwich. There's a wonderful description of the Queen going on a visitation to Norwich and being given a knitting exhibition by women children, i.e. little girls. And there were girls at one end of the dais who were actually spinning a fine worsted thread, and there were other little girls at the other end who were busily knitting it. So that we get to Mary, Queen of Scots, when she went to the scaffold, was wearing two pairs of fine worsted stockings, one pair blue and one pair white. What happens after that is that no sooner does knitting take off than fashion enters the picture and it starts to be elaborated. So you have stockings that have got clockings and embroideries and slits and different colours showing through and special party-coloured threads that are actually specially spun for the stocking trade. I like to think that what Anne did was she started out knitting. She had Gilbert coming back from London and saying, "You know what the craze is this week? It's yellow stockings or stockings with lace stitch or whatever." She got the colours and the styles from him, and then maybe she organised other women in the same situation. So she was actually organising an industry. And that would mean that eventually she began to acquire some capital, because I think she was always very frugal. So you see, part of my belief about her is that she was the one who was financially secure, and that Shakespeare never made anywhere near as much money in the theatre as people want to say, and that the theatre itself was operating in deficit, and they had serious problems of liquidity, and that the person who bought New Place, the big tumble-down house, was Anne, that she bought it because she wanted to expand her activities. One of the activities she wanted to expand into was making malt, because malt was worth more than money. It was a very valuable commodity. And she also did what other women did in her situation. She lent money and she kept money. She held money. There were no banks. So people say that I made her in my own likeness. You have no idea. A, I'm not a wife. B, I'm not quiet. I'm noisy. See, I'm not patient and long-suffering. I'm not constant. I'm the worst businesswoman you ever saw in your life. And I've never produced twins or even a baby, if it comes to that. So I don't really think I made her in my own likeness. I think she would have disapproved of me enormously.
Guardian Unlimited.